welcome to episode 12 of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for people on the go. We've reached a dozen episodes. Is that a milestone? My name is Dr. Amy Robertson, and I am here each week with my wonderful, very smart, and only slightly strange friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Williamson, for a conversation about this week's biblical text. Today, we are back into the narratives, and we get to read about King Josiah in 2 Kings chapters 22 and 23. We'll talk about the intersection of theology and history, how we discern which parts of our own life stories we ascribe to God's hand. We'll explore a text that pushes back against the idea that belief in God is necessarily linked to some reward-punishment system. We'll offhandedly meet a female prophet, and we'll contemplate the awkwardness of a conversation between a very earnest and pious Josiah and a God who is over it with the people Israel. Thanks for being with us. Hello, Bobby.
Hey, Amy. How are you this week?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks.
We're in 2 Kings. What kind of background should we provide to folks in terms of just where we are in the story of the Bible?
So we're in 2 Kings 22, and so we're in the time of King Josiah. Last week we were in Isaiah, who was set about 100 years earlier. So we're somewhere around the year 620 or thereabouts. We're in the southern kingdom of Judah. Josiah is the king, or he becomes king in this text. Josiah is about 35 years before the Babylonians come and capture Jerusalem and begin the exile in 586 or 587. So it's kind of interesting, this great reforming king, as we'll see, comes not too long before the kind of failure of the Davidic line leading into the exile. What else do you think we need to know about Josiah or the setting of this text?
I think it's interesting to think about sort of how a text like Kings relates to history, right? Because it's giving us a story and it's giving us some like touch points in history that we have some points of reference to from other ancient Near Eastern texts. So it's not floating around in the ether,
right?
It has some connection to history, but it also has a, you know, the author of this text has pretty clear, has a theology, has like a way that he thinks the world works. I mean, as we all do.
Right.
And there's sort of a lot of, I don't know if confirmation bias is the right word, but there's a lot of sort of finding evidence in history of your theology.
That way of thinking of it, I think is really helpful. Like it's a theologizing of history. Mm-hmm. So if you ask someone else, like if you ask the Babylonians or if you asked other sources outside the Bible, like why are these things happening? They would give responses in terms of, you know, the struggles of great empires or the economic challenges of being a, you know, a province of the Assyrians, these kinds of things. But when you ask the author of Joshua to 2 Kings, that author says it's because of the way the kings do or do not follow the law of God as it's given in the book of Deuteronomy.
And you mentioned Deuteronomy, and that was the other thing I would say about sort of the author of this text. Mm. The author or authors of this text love themselves some Deuteronomy.
They do so much.
Yes. So there's so much love. You might not love Deuteronomy, but this author.
How
really
could you
loves
not
Deuteronomy.
Love Deuteronomy? Oh my goodness. I mean, there's some problems with Deuteronomy.
There's some problems, but you know, it's, this author has no problems.
Yeah. There's some beautiful, wonderful things in Deuteronomy, like the, you know, the Sabbath reliefs of debts every 7 years and some great, amazing ideas. The care for the widow, the orphan, the stranger.
Mm-hmm.
But also the command to, like, annihilate the native Canaanites who are in the land before you get there. Like, yeah. So, yeah, you could have problems with Deuteronomy. I'll buy. But I like Deuteronomy. I'm a Deuteronomy fan.
Excellent. Well, then you are really going to enjoy this text.
So much so. I'm going to love this.
the author of Deuteronomy has this sense of what the ideal king would be like.
Right.
Projected into the future, because Deuteronomy is placed at least historically before there's a king. And the authors of 2 Kings are down with that.
Yes.
Yes.
The book of 2 Kings is part of what is often called, as you know, the Deuteronomistic history, which spans from Joshua to 2 Kings. And the general way of talking about that is that it's a history, as you were saying, that is theologized through the book of Deuteronomy. And we're in 2 Kings 22. The Deuteronomistic history ends in 2 Kings 25 with the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile. And so we're coming to the kind
coming
of
to the end
climax of the Deuteronomistic history. Yeah.
So should we dive in?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. I am reading from the NJPS translation. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jedidah, daughter of Adiah of Bozkath. He did what was pleasing to the Lord, and he followed all the ways of his ancestor David. He did not deviate to the right or to the left. In the 18th year of King Josiah, the king sent the scribe Shaphan, son of Azaliah, son of Meshullam, to the house of the Lord, saying, "Go to the high priest Hilkiah, and let him weigh the silver that has been deposited in the house of the Lord, which the guards of the threshold have collected from the people. And let it be delivered to the overseers of the work who are in charge at the house of the Lord, that they in turn may pay it out to the workmen that are in the house of the Lord for the repair of the house, to the carpenters, the laborers, and the masons, and for the purchase of wood and quarried stones for repairing the house. However, no check is to be kept on them for the silver that is delivered to them, for they deal honestly." Josiah was eight.
Eight.
He's a mere babe.
Just a child. It is true. Yeah. Like a third grader.
Yeah. What could go wrong?
Yeah. He's good, though. He's a good king.
Yeah. No, he's a good king. And so it doesn't tell us, you know, much of what happens while he's, you know, finishing elementary school. But he's about 26 years old, right, when it picks up in verse 3. It says the 18th year of his reign.
One of the things I wanted to note about that first little part is in verse 2, and I'm in the NRSV, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord and walked in all the ways of his father David. He did not turn aside to the right or to the left. This language, turning aside to the right or to the left, is the language of Deuteronomy. Mm-hmm. And so Josiah is one of the three kings about whom this can be said. The first is David, and then Hezekiah, who was about 100 years earlier, and then Josiah. These are the three kings who do what's right in the sight of the Lord and don't stray to the right or to the left. And so we know from the very beginning that Josiah is a good Deuteronomic king, and that he is one of the very few who gets this kind of praise from our author.
Okay, so Josiah, King Josiah, is 26 years old, and he takes on this project. What do you picture exactly happening here?
I mean, one of the things that's interesting here is that Josiah is getting ready in a minute to have a great reform after he finds a book in the temple in the next section. But it's interesting that he's already about the business of repairing the temple before any of this stuff happens with this book that they're going to discover. So Josiah is just the kind of guy who wants to take good care of the temple, and he sees the temple is in disrepair. There's money there that he could do something else with, presumably, but he is so just in his kind of natural, in his heart, in his devotion, in his way of being. He's the kind of king who wants to use the money given to the temple to make sure the temple is kept in good shape, that it's worthy of God.
Yes, it certainly speaks to his character and is sort of a way of demonstrating the ways in which he keeps the right path, the right and true path. Bobby, have you ever done any like home renovation projects?
I mean, like, I change light bulbs.
Sometimes. No, I don't mean you. I mean, like, have someone.
Oh, yeah. I just had a kind of a big one that I have no idea really what they did or how they did it. But yes, I had somebody come in and do some work on my house.
So, well, you just said you have no idea what they did or how they did it. So maybe you're not the person to ask here. But
I mean, I know what they said they did.
But what do you?
I'm a Bible scholar, so my understanding of home repair. I mean, it's not the best.
Okay, no, it doesn't have to be about home repair. But what do you think about this idea that no check shall? You're not going to check on your workers. You're just going to give them all the money.
Yeah.
And say, do what has to be done.
Yeah.
I hope this works out well for me.
ideally you find people that you trust, and then you kind of trust that they do good work.
Right.
But here it does seem to be the case that, I mean, I think that he's paying them ahead of time. Have they done the work already?
I think they're to be given all the money and then just...
Oh, yeah, let them use it to buy timber and repair the house. Yeah.
Just let them do it. Which is interesting, I think, particularly because Josiah sort of comes in with this investment in the well-being of the temple.
So, yeah, I think this says something about Josiah's trust in the people. But I think it also says something about the trustworthiness of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this, we've seen in the past with other kings that we've talked about in our reading on this podcast, that the kings are trying to manipulate people into following them, or that they don't really think the people will follow them, or the people won't do what's right unless they're bribed or persuaded in some way. Mm-hmm. And here we just have kind of a straight ahead, the king trusts the people. The people are worthy of the king's trust, and they're all kind of working toward the good of the temple. This is the way that it's supposed to be.
This is the way that it's supposed to be. Yes, yeah. You're exactly right. This is the way that it's supposed to be. Okay, verse 8. Then the high priest Hilkiah said to the scribe Shaphan, "I have found a scroll of the teaching in the house of the Lord." And Hilkiah gave the scroll to Shaphan, who read it. The scribe Shaphan then went to the king and reported to the king, "Your servants have melted down the silver that was deposited in the house, and they have delivered it to the overseers of the work who are in charge of the house of the Lord." The scribe Shaphan also told the king, "The high priest Hilkiah has given me a scroll," and Shaphan read it to the king. Now I stop there mostly because that's where the primary, I guess, verses that were selected mm-hmm. for the narrative lectionary stop.
Right.
So we should pause at least and say, like, where are we now? What's happened?
Yeah.
It's like they start cleaning out the temple, and while they're doing it, they find the instruction manual for the temple.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in this chunk of text, it doesn't tell us much more than that. It doesn't tell us what's in the teaching. It doesn't tell us what the king thinks of it or what the scribe thinks of it or anything, just that it's been found.
Yeah. And so your translation was the scroll of the instruction or something like that.
The scroll of the teaching.
Yeah. Oh, the scroll of the teaching. The NRSV is the book of the law. It's the Torah.
Yeah, right? The Torah.
Is what it says. A book of the Torah. I mean, so this is a big deal. Like, it's not just like some random text that they have found, or, you know, they have found the Torah in the text. But it seems like they don't understand really what they found. So, Hilkiah gives it to Shaphan, who reads it. And then when they bring it to the king, they say, "Hey, we did the thing with the money and, like, mm-hmm. and oh yeah, by the way, like, here's
found this scroll." Right. First they report on the silver.
Yeah.
And then they're like, "Oh yeah, we found this scroll. Let me read it to you."
Yeah. So they don't seem to know what they have, or like mm-hmm. if they know, they don't seem to think it's that important. And so it's really interesting. This thing has been so lost that they don't know. They don't even know that it matters.
Okay, so continuing, you sound like you have something else to say.
Well, I was just trying to think like that. So if you are a strict interpreter of the narrative lectionary, that would be the end of that text.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to think about, like, so, I mean, to me, it seems like the main stuff is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just trying to think, like, okay, well, if you were going to stop there, like, what would you even say about that?
I mean, I think that's a good question.
So don't stop there.
Don't stop there, right? Don't stop there.
I mean, so a couple of things to say is, so the scroll of the Torah, you know, based on what Josiah does in chapter 23 after he reads it, people generally assume or think that what he's found is some version of the book of Deuteronomy. So that at least mm-hmm. the core of Deuteronomy, chapters 12 to 26, the sort of the law part of Deuteronomy. So this is a significant thing. And it's not clear from the text, like, when did they lose track of it? And what have they been doing all this time?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you kind of think, well, I mean, the fact that the kings have not been able to follow the law very well, that kind of makes more sense if they, like, they didn't know where it was.
It does. I mean, it to me, and I'm always having empathy for these crazy Israelites, but It does give me some empathy for them that, like, no, they weren't following the law. Very problematic. They didn't even know there was a book.
I think you gotta, I don't, Yeah, you got to read verse 11 to 20. I don't think you can end in verse 10.
I agree.
Okay, let's do it. Let's go.
Let's do it. Okay. When the king heard the words of the scroll of the teaching, he rent his clothes. And the king gave orders to the prince Hilkiah and to Ahikam, son of Shaphan, Achbor, son of Micaiah, the scribe Shaphan, and Isaiah, the king's minister. Go, inquire of the Lord on my behalf, and on behalf of the people, and on behalf of all Judah, concerning the words of this scroll that has been found. For great indeed must be the wrath of the Lord that has been kindled against us, because our fathers did not obey the words of this scroll to do all that has been prescribed for us. So while Shaphan was a little casual about this scroll,
Hey, there's a book.
I'm going to read you a book. Sit down, put your feet up, King Josiah. When Josiah hears it, he tears his clothes, which is still in Jewish tradition, like a symbol, like when you hear terrible news, you rip your clothes. So he sends a group of people to inquire of the Lord to see, like, okay, this looks really bad. What are we looking at here? Right? Yeah. Is that how you take that, like, inquire on my behalf?
Yeah, so, you know, when you read the book of Deuteronomy, the covenant as it's presented in Deuteronomy is, if you follow the words of this book, then you will prosper in the land. Mm-hmm. If you do not, then you will be cursed in the land. And mm-hmm. so with that kind of contingent covenant, and Josiah is hearing this book and, like, basically, like, hearing all these things that they haven't been doing, because I guess they didn't know that they were supposed to be doing them. He's realizing the curses of Deuteronomy are headed for us, and we didn't know. And so mm-hmm. the tearing of the clothes, you know, he is shocked and afraid. And so he's inquiring of God to say, we found this book. We realize we've been doing a lot of things to make the Lord angry. Like, what do we do now?
We didn't know. We have it now.
What can we do? Anything we can do?
Right.
Yeah. I think that's what's going on.
Okay, picking up in verse 14. So the priest Hilkiah and Ahikam, Achbor, Shaphan, and Isaiah went to the prophetess Huldah, the wife of Shalom, son of Tikva, son of Harhas, the keeper of the wardrobe, who was living in Jerusalem in the Mishnah, and they spoke to her. She responded, "Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, say to the man who sent you to me, thus said the Lord, I am going to bring disaster upon..." I'm sorry.
What happened?
I just find this part funny.
You're so weird. Why is it funny?
Because Josiah's like, oh crap.
Yeah.
And he's like, go check on the God. And God says, telleth the man who has cometh to thee, you are so screwed. You're right, you're screwed. I'm glad you asked, because you're screwed.
That's my favorite.
Glad you checked in. Thus said the Lord, I am going to bring disaster upon this place and its inhabitants, in accordance with all the words of the scroll which the king of Judah has read. Because they have forsaken me and have made offerings to other gods and vexed me with all their deeds, my wrath is kindled against this place, and it shall not be quenched. But say this to the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of the Lord. Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, as for the words which you have heard, because your heart was softened and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard what I decreed against this place and its inhabitants, that it will become a desolation and a curse. And because you rent your clothes and wept before me, I, for my part, have listened, declares the Lord. Assuredly, I will gather you to your fathers, and you will be laid in your tomb in peace. Your eyes shall not see all the disaster which I will bring upon this place. So they brought back the reply to the king. So what Josiah has earned himself here is an early death.
Well...
Right?
No, I mean...
Congratulations, Josiah. You're going to die before it gets really bad.
I mean, so the way that I read it is, hey, Josiah, because y'all have not been following the law, even though you didn't remember that there was one. I'm going to come in vengeance. But because you have tried to be faithful as best you knew how, I'm going to wait until you die.
Oh, that does sound better than I'll kill you first.
Yeah. So that I will gather you to your ancestors and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace usually means that you're going to die of old age and you're going to be buried with your people. So you're not going to die in battle. You're not going to die like tragically. I'm going to wait until you pass peacefully. You'll get to be buried among your fathers. And then here I come, right? God is saying this like, here's a little bit of good news for you. But like the news is not good, right? I'm coming for Judah. But I'm going to wait until after you. It would be a very selfish person who would think like, oh, good. Well, it's not going to happen in my lifetime. And so
which certainly is not the character we've seen of Josiah.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that, I mean, God is fully aware that like, hey, we just found this book. Like we didn't know. And God's response is basically like, yeah, sorry about that. Like you should have known. And, you know, there's some responsibility of your ancestors. The book should not have been lost and you should have known. So the fact that you didn't, like, sorry about that, but I got to do what I got to do.
Right. It sort of is like the system works as the system works. It's not about you didn't mean to do a bad thing. Bad things have been done.
Wouldn't you hate to be those guys who, like, got that message from Huldah and then the last verse here is they took the message back to the
I know.
Like, what if that's the
can
worst?
You picture, and then the Bible doesn't tell us about that conversation, but can you even imagine, like, well?
Yeah. Because these are some of the same folks that found the book in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they just were like, huh, we found a scroll.
Right, we found like, the instruction manual for the oven. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now they got to go back and tell Josiah.
Right. So the good news is that you're going to die in peace.
Yeah. Can you imagine going back and being like, so which do you want? So there's good news and there's bad news. Like, which one do you want first?
And like the good news is like a solid C-. It's like a C-. That is not good news.
Yeah. The good news is you're going to be okay. The bad news.
I mean, you're going to be okay, but they talk about it in terms of death. The good news is you're going to have a good death. I also just want to note here that we have a prophetess. Which is not such a common thing. We have four named prophetesses in the Hebrew Bible, and Huldah is one of them. And the text doesn't seem particularly interested in the fact that it's a female prophet, but there she is in all her glory.
Yeah, so when you say not interested, you just mean...
I mean it's just not worthy of additional comment.
It seems to be such a normal thing.
Right, exactly.
You don't need to make a deal about it.
There's nothing to say about it. That's the prophet who was closest by. That's who they went to.
Mm-hmm. Who are so? I know when you say there are four named prophetesses, female prophets in the Bible. I've got Huldah. I've got Miriam. I've got Deborah.
In Nehemiah chapter 6, there is one called Noadiah.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Let's see what happens next.
Let's do.
Chapter 23. At the king's summons, all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem assembled before him. The king went up to the house of the Lord, together with all the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and prophets, all the people young and old. And he read to them the entire text of the covenant scroll which had been found in the house of the Lord. The king stood by the pillar and solemnized the covenant before the Lord, that they would follow the Lord and observe his commandments, his injunctions, and his laws with all their heart and soul, that they would fulfill all the terms of this covenant as inscribed upon the scroll, and all the people entered into the covenant. Okay, so what does Josiah do with this? He doesn't go weep in a corner or decide to live out his days on a sailboat because there's nothing he could. I mean, he's basically been told, there's nothing you can do.
Right.
This is signed, sealed, and delivered. So the end.
Yeah.
So what does he do? He gathers everybody, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All the inhabitants of Jerusalem.
Yep.
Priests and the prophets, all the people young and old. And he read the entire text of the covenant scroll.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a command in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 31 that everybody should be assembled and the words of the law should be read out loud to the community. Mm-hmm. So in kind of a roundabout way, Josiah is now trying to do that. And then the people recommit themselves to the covenant. So we've seen this recommitment to the covenant periodically. We saw it with the generation after the Exodus at Sinai. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you see mm-hmm. it again in Joshua mm-hmm. 23 and 24, the people recommit to the covenant. Here you see it again. Yeah, so the response to this bad news of there's nothing you can do is we're going to recommit ourselves to the covenant. We're mm-hmm. all in. We're gonna do our best to obey the law from here forward.
Pretend you're Josiah.
Okay.
Bobby, you're 26 years old.
Yeah.
So think back to that time. Oof. So pretend you're Josiah. You're very righteous. You just got some really bad news. Do you think that he is trying to, do you think that he sort of doesn't believe it's really signed, sealed, and delivered? Or do you think he's just do what's right because it's right, not because you're going to avoid the horrible yeah. fate that's just been described to you?
You know, the text doesn't make any real comment about Josiah's trying to sway God or anything like that.
No, there's no bargaining. He is no Abraham.
Yeah. No, that's right.
Mm-mm.
So yeah, I think, you know, I think I tend to incline, although I'm not sure I would have necessarily gone there when I first read it, but your sort of second move is Josiah's just doing what's right because it's right.
And he doesn't tell the people their fate.
That's true too, yeah.
He just reads them the scroll.
Yep.
And gets them to recommit to it.
So he knows that there's kind of this prophecy of doom, but he's sort of, I mean, he doesn't tell them, I guess, because, I mean, well, let me just ask you, why, do you have any thoughts about like what his motivation in not telling them might be?
I mean, if you're really doomed, if Josiah believes this is a done deal, what's the point in telling people? It's yeah. just going to ruin the days they have.
Yeah. You know, 23 goes on to describe the rest of the kinds of reforms that the people make in mm-hmm. tearing down the high places and getting rid of the Asherahs and things like that, kind of returning to proper worship of the
mm-hmm.
Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of chapter 23, then you have a king and a people who have really recommitted themselves, kind of almost the high point of the kingdom of Judah since David maybe. And yet in the background is this sense of the doom that is about to come.
Right. And as readers of the biblical text, we know does come.
Yeah.
The doom comes. They do not get out of it. But it does. This text raises a lot of really interesting questions for our communities and our time and sort of how we grapple in lots of different ways. Do you have one in particular that is speaking to you or a couple that are speaking to you, Bobby?
I do. I mean, I've been wrestling a lot with, so what's the message of this text? And it's not entirely obvious to me, but so a couple of things that I've been pondering anyway. One of them is this idea that we are responsible for things even if we didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea that Josiah was responsible for having followed the Torah even though he didn't know the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the good news is in that, really, if one thinks in terms of like trying to proclaim good news from the text. But the idea is that we're responsible for these commands. And just because we are ignorant of the text, or we have lost the text, or we have quit reading the text, or we have amnesia about the text, this isn't any kind of excuse. And, you know, when you think about what is in the book of Deuteronomy, I was saying at the beginning in our conversation earlier on that I love the book of Deuteronomy. And the things that I really love about the book of Deuteronomy are the provisions that are there for about how people live in the world economically. And so there's the forgiveness of debts every 7 years, where you kind of reset the economy. So people should never fall into generational debt because the community resets itself so people can live full and happy lives. There's the care of the widow, the orphan, and the stranger. There's the idea that one should, when you glean your field, you ought to leave part of your gleanings left over so people can come and gather. So no one is starving to death while people are hoarding
mm-hmm.
their resources. So there's a lot of really beautiful stuff in the book of Deuteronomy that our culture, our society seems to have forgotten. And we don't care for people the way that we should. And we do let people fall into generational debt. And we do charge exorbitant interest rates on debt that people can't pay, and so they end up kind of becoming enslaved in their own way to the economy. And these are things that the book of Deuteronomy speaks against, and we're responsible for those things. even though we might say, well, we didn't know that, or we might say, well, the book of Deuteronomy doesn't, what does Deuteronomy have to do with me, right? And this text is saying, even if you think Deuteronomy has nothing to do with you, from within the family of faith, the book does have something to do with you. And just because you think it doesn't, like, that's no excuse.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I'm thinking about, and I don't know, like, this is a super unformed thought that has just occurred to me while we've been talking right now, is...
Those are my favorites.
Yeah. This thing about there is doom coming, and just because you didn't know you were creating doom doesn't mean you're not responsible for it. Is making me think about the current situation of climate change, mm-hmm. and this sense of we've been living our lives in certain kind of ways, not really knowing what we were doing to ourselves. And maybe now that we've become aware of what we're doing to ourselves, it might be too late. And yet we have some kind of generational responsibility to try to do what we can do. We can't be like the imaginary king you and I were talking about, who would say mm-hmm. like, oh, well, at least I'm going to die before...
Before it gets really bad. Yeah.
Before this thing happens, so like, let me go eat a cheeseburger. But instead, to be like Josiah, who like makes a public mm-hmm. cry and says like, "Hey, here's the thing that's happening, and I know that God said it's too late, but we're gonna do our best to make the changes that need to be made, and that's all we can do, and we mm-hmm. have some responsibility about that for future generations." We can't use the fact that it might not make a difference as an excuse for not doing anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really like that. And the connection to climate change is terrifying and true,
mm-hmm.
I think. It's something that, you know, we didn't create ourselves. We inherited it. We didn't know what we were doing. Many people before us didn't know what we were doing. And it doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, exactly. We are at a crisis. And yeah, so thinking about how we deal with that now, whether we sort of put our heads in the sand and say, well, it's too late, or it's overwhelming, I can't think about it, I'm not going to do anything.
Right.
You know, we're not in the position of the people of Jerusalem in that we are at least somewhat aware of our situation here. Yeah, that is one of the messages that I sort of have taken from this too, also largely from this conversation of how do we think about Josiah's decision to recommit himself and help his people, lead his people to recommit to the Torah, to Deuteronomy, even when there is no indication that that's going to make any difference
right.
whatsoever. And what that made me think of, which is a little less scary and immediate in my own life, I feel like religion gets a bad rap, Bobby. But one of the things it gets a bad rap for is this idea that religious people, I think Jews and Christians and in particular, I don't know if other religions do, only do right because there's this fear of punishment.
Mm.
Like there's a fear of punishment, like the curses in Deuteronomy, or there's a fear of going to hell, or there's a fear, like there's some stick that sort of keeps us in line. And I feel like Josiah here is the ultimate example of not that. Is just like, we're going to do the right thing. And we've already been told we're going to be punished regardless, but we're going to do the right thing because we're going to do the right thing.
Right.
So I think that's a really good model, a good corrective to that. It's occasionally true, but I think generally untrue portrayal of religious folk.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that I'm...
That's good.
That I'm thinking of. And then the other is just this sort of question, almost more sort of empathizing with the Deuteronomistic writer of this text or writers of this text, is to think about how we see God in our theology, in our lives, and sort of what process of discernment we go through to say, like, that was God... That wasn't God.
Yeah.
That means this in relationship to God. Like, God's a pretty, that's some pretty big guns to bring into your story, your narrative of something.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see sort of the way it plays out in this text, but it makes me think too of the way that we might walk through the world and see God or godliness or not in mm-hmm. different places. Okay. So next week we have coming Jeremiah. Chapter 33, verses 14 to 18. That's awfully a short text.
Maybe it is we'll a super short
that.
Text.
Maybe yeah. we'll expand that a little bit. I haven't looked at it yet, but knowing us, I think
we should talk about the whole book of Jeremiah.
Oh, that'll take a while.
Yeah.
Well, Bobby, I think that I have had far more fun than anyone should be able to have with this text today.
You didn't. You really did have a good time with this text, which kind of worries me a little bit.
Well, before we go completely off the rails, I think that we should bid farewell and plan to talk again next week.
Farewell, everyone.
Farewell, y'all. Good to talk. See you next week. Thank you for joining us for another episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. Next week, we'll be in Jeremiah chapter 33. Until then, have a great week.